Wednesday comes the Dr. Catherine Ulrich Show. 2 hours of mentally stimulating, thought-provoking, sometimes maddening, but hopefully always inspiring talk radio. I'm your host, Dr. Catherine Ulrich. Today is Wednesday, December 3rd, and did you guys catch this story? This is in the D.C. Examiner. Oh, my gosh. They just opened the Capitol Visitor Center. You know, we got all these Democrats now flooding into the Capitol. $621 million. Can you imagine? Just think for a minute. $621 million for the Capitol Visitor Center. That could build a whole lot of mansions, a whole lot of McMansions, you think? $621 million. And I love this. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, here was his response to this. He said, well, once we have this thing in place, we won't have to smell the tourists anymore. Talk about elitist. Let me read you this article. The Capitol Visitor Center, which opened yesterday morning, may have tripled its original budget, totally ran over, and fallen years behind schedule. But Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid found a silver lining for members of Congress. Tourists won't offend them with their B.O. anymore. And he says, my staff tells me not to say this. Why staff there, Harry Reid? You should have listened to him. But I'm going to say it anyway, said Reid in his remarks. In the summer, because of the heat and the high humidity, you could literally smell the tourists coming into the Capitol. It may be descriptive, but it is true. But it's no longer going to be true because now all of those tourists are going to be herded off, probably behind the little velvet ropes or maybe the big wrought iron gates, or who knows how they're going to keep them out now of the Senate so that the senators will no longer have to smell regular people. Maybe they'll be behind the barbed wire. I don't know. But they're going to be off at a $621 million Capitol Visitor Center. Mind-blowing. You know, this is part of this ongoing trend to eliminate the middle class. And I know that you're like, eliminate the middle class? How does that tie in? It really ties in with a mindset. You know, there's the us's and there's the them's. There's those of us at the top who hold the marionette strings and hold the puppet strings and decide what's going to happen with everybody else. And then there are all of the peons out there who have to live under our dictates. But, you know, those people really don't count anyway because they don't smell good. They don't have good hygiene. They're not educated in Ivy League schools. They don't wear expensive $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 suits. And therefore, their opinions and their experiences don't matter. I find this attitude within the United States really appalling. And it's one that's really been growing and spreading. You guys notice this? What was the Arnold Schwarzenegger quote? Let me see if I can dig it up here. Arnie, along with many of his other offensive quotes, and believe me, he's made his share since he's been in the limelight, not just as a bodybuilder and as an actor, but of course now also as the governor of the state of California. But he made this statement that I thought was just shocking, and I thought I had it right here. He made a statement that essentially when it comes to power and authority, he is all for it. And then he goes on to say 95% of the public need somebody else to tell them what to do, and he is just the person to do it. It's like, whoa. Yeah, see, that elitist attitude, and that really is the ultimate meaning of the word elitist, that idea that I am at the top and the rest of you, you know, at my pleasure, at my pleasure, I guess, meaning with my permission, you can have a decent life. You know, I'll look out for you there and pat you on the head. But ultimately, what really matters is what happens with us rich fat cats. So here's the quote. I actually found it. My relationship to power and authority is that I'm all for it. People need somebody to watch over them. 95% of the people in the world need to be told what to do and how to behave. Is that you? That's certainly not me. And I don't think I'm like part of some small 5% elitist minority here. I think that most people in this country, and certainly most people under Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger as residents of the state of California, and he certainly views them as under him, would probably disagree pretty mightily to this statement. 95% of the people in the world need to be told what to do and how to behave. And the thing I like about this quote is Arnold Schwarzenegger really has, he's got a deserved reputation for just saying what he thinks. He doesn't hold back. And while other lawmakers, oh, maybe the Hillary Clintons or certainly not the Harry Reid's, he kind of came out and said it too, but other lawmakers with a little more political savvy and a little better understanding of which way the wind blows, they know better than to say garbage like this. So instead, they couch it in other terms of, oh, hardworking American men and women deserve blah, blah, blah. You know, George Bush, whoever his speechwriters are, do a pretty good job. You know, the American people, you'll hear that over and over again. But I bet you when you get these guys behind closed doors and they're smoking cigars in their smoke-filled rooms, that they're referring to us in the most absolutely patronizing, condescending, and insulting of terms. So here you got Henry Reid. I don't know about you. I have no desire to go to this this new visitor center over there at Congress that they've put together. I just find the whole thing offensive. And, you know, what an awful thing to say. He said, my staffers told me not to say it. Well, because his staffers knew that saying that would make him sound like a really elitist creep and, you know, reveal his true colors. Maybe they know him better. Maybe they know him better than he knows himself. All right. Let me give out the phone line here. If you want to call in on any issues related to elitism, it's 1-800-259-9231. Again, 1-800-259-9231. My email address, of course, is kma@spychips.com. The website, of course, katherinealbrecht.com or gcnlive.com to catch the show. And definitely on this issue of elitism, I've talked about it before. I'm a big believer in books. I think books are a great way to learn from the wisdom of previous generations. And Ira Levin, who's not that far back historically, he was the author of Rosemary's Baby, but he wrote a very poignant book that is exactly to the point on this called That Perfect Day. And in that book, it really is about how the elites kind of live in their own world of treats. And when you look at how the evil dictators and oppressors worldwide and across the centuries have lived, they've all done the same thing. One of my favorite articles that I ever read was an article, just because it so illustrated this point and was so disgusting, was an article about making pizza for Kim Jong-il. Kim Jong-il, the president, dictator, life ruler, demigod of North Korea, he actually, when he gets hungry, gets a hankering for some foreign food, he doesn't do what the rest of us do and, you know, pick up the phone and call out for pizza. Not that in starving North Korea that would be an option anyway, given that people there are continually subjected to famine and eating bark off the trees and eating grass clippings. But when he gets hungry, what he does is he doesn't just, you know, call it for a pizza or have his private chef whip one up. He brings over a chef from Italy and his whole entourage. And the story, making pizza for Kim Jong-il, if you can actually find it on the internet and read it. It's just a riveting edge of your seat kind of read about this weird country of North Korea and how, again, you know, Kim Jong-il, like all these other guys, he views himself as being above the fray. And when he's hungry, he just flies people in. He puts this Italian chef up for like a couple of, I think it was even a couple of weeks. And at one point even discusses the possibility of building a wood-fired oven so that he can have pizza anytime he wants it. So not just sticking it in the regular oven like the rest of us, but actually building his own wood-fired oven. And that notion that these elites are in a position to be experiencing the best of the best is one we've had our noses rubbed in. How many times in the last year? Every time the international leaders get together or the group of 20 got together in D.C. or whenever they gather, there are always these sort of breathless reports of what was on the menu. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, if I ever had one of those big dinners and I had, oh, I don't know, Madeleine Albright there and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, had all these important people. You know what I might do is when it came time to serve the wonderful meal, I'd have all the waiters come out in their waiter suits and deposit like 3 pinto beans on a plate and say, here you go. Now you can see what it really feels like to experience world hunger. And no, there won't be seconds. Yeah. Wouldn't that be fun? The looks on their faces. All right, we'll be right back.
Cascadia Public Radio.
Mm-hmm. driving into fear, and there's office rubble and awful trouble sometimes. There's dust collecting on the floor, and it's here we go, another war. But I don't sweat it, I won't be getting in line.
Where's the airplane? Where are my wings? Sign me up. All right, we got the phone lines open, 1-800-259-9231. How do you feel about being called by Majority Leader, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, the smelly tourists? I mean, come on. Who do these guys think pay their salaries? And yet they spend $600 million of our money, $620-plus million of our money. Our money, that is, our money. I never remember getting asked if I wanted some big fancy tourist center so that those guys wouldn't have to smell the members of the public, and yet they take our money at gunpoint and put it into things like that. It's just shocking. It's just unbelievable. And I, for one, am offended. He's offended by BO. I'm offended by him. Okay. Phone lines open, 1-800-259-9231. Let's go to Mike in Illinois. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind this afternoon?
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, we're considered the great unwashed. That's what they think. The regular people that are, you know, supporting this economy and everything are looked down upon. They think we're complete idiots. And the audacity of this senator to say that before everybody, I mean, right, you know, he didn't care. He even had advisors saying don't do it. But the fact is he didn't care. And what he did was say their true feelings. And that's how they look at us. You know, they pulled the wool over our eyes. We've become so complacent that we let everything slide by. And you know that from talking to people. If you try to explain anything that's going on, you know, anything that's sort of out of the norm, they don't want to hear it.
Well, so do you think then that Senator Harry Reid is on to something when he says that the great masses out there, I mean, he's referring to their body odor,
right,
apparently. I mean,
right.
He's actually smelling them. Come on.
They probably have body odor standing outside waiting to get in there or whatever.
Do you know? I'm trying to think who it was. Was it George Bush? One of these guys was actually talking about getting a hepatitis shot because he was going to go to a NASCAR race.
Really? Oh, that's right. That's right. I remember that. And
I think it was GW. I think he was going to go get himself a hepatitis shot. How do you get hepatitis from, like, even sitting around a bunch of people with hepatitis? Unless you're sharing needles or engaged in intimate body fluid exchange, you're not going to be getting hepatitis. But
exactly. Just
the mindset that a NASCAR event would be such unwashed masses that I might get a disease. And so, you know, what is he doing? Calling up the Surgeon General saying inoculate me against everything? I'm going into the third world. I mean, come on.
Little does he realize he's probably going to get hepatitis from the shot.
Yeah.
You know, my daughter's school, high school daughter, she was not allowed back in school unless she got a hepatitis shot. And I went in there and I said, look, you know, the only people that really get hepatitis are, you know, either prostitutes or people that, you know, share drug needles and things like this. And I said, I don't see her doing that, you know. And they said, you know, that's it. Either she's expelled.
How old was she?
That's it. She was 17 at the time. And I took her out of school. I took her out of that school.
Good for you. Wow. That's quite a story. Well, and a hepatitis shot is one of the least, I mean, that is such a lifestyle related disease that you're not going to be getting that, you know, just from walking around. You're not going to pick that up off of a toilet seat or anything. But hang on, let me see. Here's the story here. Democratic congressional staffers got hepatitis shots before attending a NASCAR race in North Carolina.
Oh, my God. That's amazing, isn't it?
The
elite, you know, Bush's crowd there and everybody else in Washington there, they consider themselves the elite. They they look down upon people, and they think they're complete idiots.
Well, I got another really terrific story for you. John Kerry, when John Kerry was campaigning and made a campaign stop, a photo opportunity at a Wendy's restaurant, right? Wendy's restaurant. He had, you know, kind of the movable palace on wheels, the big motor vehicle thing that was driving him around, and his entourage, this big huge thing with a big Kerry poster on the side. Anyway, they go into the Wendy's and they order, you know, a burger and fries, and they all sit down and they're talking, and the flash bulbs are all flashing. Everybody's taking his picture. And one of the reporters happens to notice that he doesn't touch his food. And
right.
What they then find out, as I think one of these was even like an embedded reporter, is that he had ordered a special meal from the local country club where they brought in this like 5-course meal, and I think it was filet mignon and shrimp and who knows what. So they all
right.
sat in their portable palace eating like kings and queens instead of touching the Wendy's food. And I thought, man, you know, or what was the other one when, was it George Bush Sr. or G.W. Jr.? One of them had never seen a grocery store scanner before, picked it up with a little laser beaming around and went, what's this?
Oh my God.
Never even been in a store. What kind of a weird life do you lead?
Right,
you know,
they're like Paris Hilton there with the Walmart or something.
To have never even gone into a store and seen a barcode scanner, how do they think things get bought in the world?
So, I have no idea. They're totally out of touch. I got to say it. I'm just sickened by the whole government scenario there and all the hidden agendas. And, again, Kennedy was the one that was going to expose them, and I'm sure that had a great deal to do with his demise. But,
yeah, well, there's a whole lot of questions still floating around that, and probably will be for a long time, probably until the whole generation is dead and then all of it will surface once nobody...
Right. Well, and what gave Johnson the right to close those documents for, what, 80 years or something like this? I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure as to the time, but...
You know, I think it was the same executive order that gave the investigators of the World Trade Center disaster the right to cart away all the evidence before they looked at it. You think it might have been?
Mm-hmm, I do. Well, here is the crime scene. And what do? They take it all away. Oh.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Who,
I know.
Whose idea was that, you know?
Oh, yeah, and yet they figure that those unwashed masses are probably too stupid to figure it out. Anyways, it doesn't really matter.
And
I mean, come on.
We're too stupid to know that, you know, this bombing in, where was that?
Mumbai?
Mumbai, right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a prelude to bombing here. You know, that's not going to happen here now. But, you know, this is what it is. Anything that goes on, there are no mistakes. So anything that goes on is going to happen eventually here to, you know, it's sort of like a prelude showing us how that happened. And, oh, my God, it's right now in the United States.
Well, and I think certainly the media here would like to capitalize on the fact that something happened elsewhere because, you know, it's useful. And it's juicy news, and it's useful to continue moving forward with all of these expensive security initiatives here. So, hey, Mike, I appreciate the call. Yeah, thanks for winning. Appreciate that. We'll be right back and take more of your phone calls right after this, 1-800-259-9231. Stay with us.
This is the GCN Radio Network, home to hard-hitting talk radio.
I would turn on the TV, but it's so embarrassing to see all the other people. I don't know what they mean. And it was magic at first when they spoke without sound. But now this world is gonna hurt. You better turn that thing down. Turn it around. Well, it wasn't me, says the boy with the gun. Sure, I pulled the trigger, but it needed to be done because life's been killing me ever since it begun. You can't blame me, cause I'm too young.
All right, we're back. Phone lines are open, 1-800-259-9231. You're listening to the Dr. Catherine Olbrecht Show. We're talking about the unwashed masses, and I just found this article. NASCAR fans pose no health hazard. This is right after that disgusting statement made yesterday by Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, referring to tourists who visit the Capitol as being smelly, and now he won't have to smell them anymore because he can just stick them in the brand new $620 million tourist center that they've built to shuffle them all away. I don't know if it's behind barbed wire or exactly what, but in light of that, let me read you about NASCAR fans pose no health hazard. Before last week's NASCAR race at Talladega, this was last October, the chief of the Homeland Security Committee advised staffers to get immunized against hepatitis A, hepatitis B, tetanus, diphtheria, and influenza. Where did these guys think they were going to be going? Were they like headed to, I don't know, like the third world? Were they going down to, you know, Mexico City? Were they heading out into the slums outside of New Delhi? Where did they think they were going? My gosh. Representative Benny Thompson says the recommendation for the immunizations was made because staffers visit hospitals at nearby care facilities and are exploring health preparedness at large events. That, I think that was kind of an after-the-fact explanation to cover all of the political fallout of that. Isn't that funny? And the North Carolina Congressman Robin Hayes reacted, saying NASCAR fans, quote, don't pose any health hazard to anyone. Oh, my gosh, disgusting. All right, phone lines are open. Let me go back to those phones, 1-800-259-9231, and let's say hello to Billy calling in from New Jersey. Hey, Billy.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi there.
I'm a new listener, and I actually wanted to call today because I want to talk about gun control.
Okay, well, the Jack Johnson song we just heard was kind of a little bit about guns, but, yeah, go right ahead. I'm all ears.
Well, as you know, crime is exploding and everything, and as the economy gets worse, as it's predicted to, and crime is going to skyrocket. So I just wanted to get your opinion on guns. And I know, for example, in New Jersey, have some of the worst gun laws. And, like, how do you convince someone to get a gun? Because right now I'm 19, and right now, like, I'm at home with my parents, and my mother really doesn't believe in guns. And I think now is probably the best time to get a gun, especially since we have Barack Obama coming in January. And I would just like to get your take on it, basically.
Yeah. Those are some great questions. Are you in a really dangerous part of New Jersey?
It's not. New Jersey in general is just a really crummy state. I just don't get why anyone would want to live here. I mean, in particular, the town where I'm in isn't really dangerous, but the surrounding towns are. Yes.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, let me fess up, and regular listeners have already heard this from me, but as a new listener, you probably haven't. I once, years ago, when I was young and stupid, in fact, I was probably a little bit older than you, so you are like young and brilliant. I was young and stupid. And I actually gave money to Sarah Brady's gun control organization way back when. I didn't know any better. I really believed, like so many Americans are brainwashed through the schools and through the mainstream media, to believe that guns are bad and that guns kill people and that therefore we need to eliminate them and only leave them in the hands of government officials and the authorities. Well, what I've since come to understand through many, many years of maturing and figuring things out from the time I was 19 or 20, is that what actually kills people in much larger numbers than anything else is people's own governments. The people's own governments were six times more deadly during the 20th century than all of the century's wars combined. So the most deadly force on earth by far is government. And for that reason, it was the founders of this country who fully understood that they provided for us the Bill of Rights and the Second Amendment that ensured us the ability to remain armed so that we can protect ourselves. And especially, I believe that they were protecting us against that form of tyranny that has happened so many times throughout human history, when the government becomes evil and starts killing people under its own charge, which has happened, you know, more times than I could even enumerate on the air in a two-hour program. So from my perspective, that was kind of the theoretical or philosophical turning point for me when I began to realize, hey, wait a minute, if you take the guns away from the people, which was the first thing Hitler did with the Jews when he began taking over Germany, he disarmed all the Jews. If you take the guns away from the people and the only people left with guns are government, and government is the most deadly force on the planet, far more deadly than random crimes or kidnapping or muggings or burglary or breaking and entry or outright murder, government is way more deadly than that. So why would I want those guys to be the only ones with the guns? So philosophically, I was there. But let me tell you what it took to actually change my opinion from like a visceral gut level. And that was living through the L.A. riots. I was, how old was I? I was probably 20-something. And I remember when those riots broke out and there were bands of crazed people going up and down the streets. They were breaking the windows of the grocery stores. They were everywhere. My mom went to fill a prescription. And when she was in filling this like life or death prescription for my grandfather, a band of people ran into the store, demanded everybody get down on the ground and then started breaking things. You know, my poor mom. So during this whole, she escaped unscathed. She did have to lie on the floor, though, while they broke all of the glass cases and stole all the watches and the electronics and the cameras. So it really was a really scary time. And I remember sitting there in my rented house that I lived in with all these windows, you know, with the yard, with no possible protection at all, and sitting in there with the curtains drawn and a baseball bat across my lap while I watched all this stuff unfolding on the news. And realizing that if one of those bands came to my house and broke the window, they could easily break the window next to the door, reach in, you know, I could try smashing with the baseball bat, but they could just, you know, they'd be through the door in a minute, that I had no way to protect myself. And it was at that moment I said, yikes, why have I been supporting gun control? I need a gun. And at that moment, when all hell breaks loose and your society really does go crazy, or even if all hell breaks loose just in your house and there is some hellion trying to get into your house, that's the moment when you want to be armed. And even despite all of that, I did not myself own a gun until 2005. When somebody employed by the RFID industry actually sicked some kind of investigator tail on me, who was getting into my bank accounts, getting into my phone records, and scaring the daylights out of me. And I went out and I got a gun, and I went to the shooting range and got very good at using it, and I got myself a concealed carry permit. And I during that span of time, I remember, you know, I'd go downstairs to my own kitchen to get a glass of milk and I'd have the gun with me because I would think, you know, this, somebody could be through my window and in my house within a matter of seconds. And I need to be able to protect myself. So, you know, it's those experiences. And I think especially as women, the Second Amendment Sisters has some great information for women as to why, you know, we of all people with our sort of physical vulnerability need to be armed and why we have a right to be armed and to protect ourselves. So, you know, maybe some of their information would help your mom a little bit.
Okay. No, but I thought of that, but then at the same time, like, for example, she stated, like, forms of protection that we have a, like, bat knife, but that's not going to be anything if things all go to hell in a handbasket.
Well, that you're going to have what?
Knives and bats. That's not going to be anything if everything goes to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, you know, it's not, because you think to yourself, oh, yeah, this baseball bat will do me fine until you're actually scared. And you're like, what in the heck is this baseball bat going to do for me? You know, I need to get the guy when he's 20 feet away coming through the door, not when he's within 3 feet of me and I swing the bat and he's just going to grab it and laugh at me. You know, I need to stop him on the other side of the room. So that was really a big turning point for me. There's also, you may want to turn her on to JPFO, Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, online at jpfo.org. When we come back from the break, I'll give you a few more tips because I got a bunch of them. Stay with us.
Around and bound to troubled days. And every time we stand up, dust each other off. I know we may be losing, but we ain't lost. Bring it on, bring it on. I seen the rain tumbling down. I felt the cold wind blow. I seen trouble hanging round. Bring it on, bring it on.
All right, we're back. You're listening to Dr. Catherine Albrecht at GCNLive.com, also online at CatherineAlbrecht.com, where you can find the archives downloadable as easy-to-grab MP3 files that you can load up onto your iPod or press onto a CD and take with you. All of that online, Catherine Albrecht with a K, KathrineAlbrecht. I should have had an easier to spell name, but there you go. KathrineAlbrecht.com. All right, just before the break, we were talking with Billy in New Jersey about the issue of gun control and crime. And, of course, I'm a big believer in the Second Amendment. I think all of those freedoms and protections that were put into the Constitution were designed specifically because the founding fathers of this country understood the ever-present danger of government tyranny and meant to protect us from them. So, Billy, are you still with us? Not sure if we still have Billy. Maybe we lost Billy here. A couple of tips I wanted to give you, though, if you are listening online here or through your radio. Hang on, let me see if I can find this. All right, two tips real quick. Dial 911 and die is a book that I think might be helpful for those of you living in urban areas who believe that you can just call 911 and save your life in that way. It's by Richard W. Stevens. You can find a link to that by looking it up in Ixquick, ixquick.com instead of google.com. I'm trying to switch people over away from privacy invading Google and over towards Ixquick. But dial 911 and die is one option. It has an introduction by James Bovard, one of my favorite authors, the author of Lost Rights. But that's got, I think, some pretty useful information in here. Provides full citations to statutes and lots of legal information. But I think more importantly, tells you that under current law, you can sue for almost anything, but you cannot sue the police for failing to protect citizens. So it has many, many cases of where people dialed 911 and then wound up having nobody ever show up and wound up dead and murdered because they could not defend themselves. So relying on someone else in a case like that is probably a bad idea. The other references I would give you, the Second Amendment Sisters, of course, great organization. Was she our national leader, I think, Jen Coffey? Has been a guest on our program in the past and can give you more information about the Second Amendment Sisters online. And I'm at Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, jpfo.org, Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. They bill themselves as America's most aggressive defender of firearms ownership. And you would think of all people who would appreciate the reason not to be disarmed, that certainly the Jewish people would be clear on that point after what happened to them in Nazi Germany and elsewhere around the world where they've been disarmed. And usually when a government wants to disarm a people, it wants to disarm those people because it wants to render them helpless in a lot of ways. So lots of great information, lots of good essays, lots of, let's see, I'm trying to think, they've got some great movies at JPFO about the philosophical reasons to want to support firearms ownership. They got great posters that you can download for free. So there's a whole lot out there. And then finally, maybe somebody can help me out with the name. I was doing a quick search during the break and not finding it. Of the researcher who has proven that guns save lives, I cannot remember his name, but he's the researcher that has actually shown that when gun control is introduced in communities, that violent crime rates actually go up and that you have higher rates of break-ins and murders when gun control is in full effect than when people are actually allowed the private ownership of guns. And that makes sense. You know, if you've got a sign outside your door that says, I am armed and I have a gun, then, you know, the criminal's going to move on. They're going to go to the next house where it says, I am unarmed and I believe in Sarah Brady's Gun Control Inc. and I send them money every month. That's going to look like a much more appealing target. The other thing that has me concerned, you guys remember the case a couple of years ago where a British homeowner shot and killed one of two punks who had come into his house to rob him. And I can't remember if he used a shotgun, but anyway, he killed one of them and had this long, drawn-out trial, and he just received his sentencing, I think, within the last couple of weeks, maybe even the last couple of days. And he was sentenced to life in prison. Life in prison. When known criminals with criminal records break into his own house, threaten his life, scare him to death. He's there in bed where he actually put the firearm next to his bed so that if they had broken in before, so that if they broke in again, he could defend himself. And when they came into the bedroom, he hauled off and shot him, and now he is spending life in prison in Great Britain. So that's one of the other downsides. When you start getting into this idea that citizens do not have the right to defend themselves, then defending yourself becomes a criminal act. And I just cannot imagine what it would mean to say, you're in my house, you're threatening me, you're scaring the bejeebers out of me, I've got a gun, and I'm not going to shoot it because I don't want to spend a lifetime in prison. Maybe I could just talk to you. Let's have a little chat. Let me make some tea, shall we? I don't think so. You know, when these people are in your house, clearly they're bent on doing you harm, or they wouldn't be breaking into your house in the first place. Oh, my gosh. So, yeah. I know that this is one of the contentious issues, and the reason that it is so incredibly contentious is because the election of Barack Obama, which I've said many, many times, was orchestrated and intentionally put together so that, among other things, they will be able to strip us of our Second Amendment gun rights. That's exactly what's going to start happening. So I have heard that gun sales and ammunition sales have gone through the roof, have had just a brisk upswing since Obama's election, because people, I think, are hoarding. I think that they are storing up and burying guns in their basements or in their backyards so that when the confiscation begins and people are no longer able to buy guns, that they will at least have some kind of a backup plan. Scary stuff. The good news is that there are a lot of gun owners in this country. A lot. And that is in large part because the U.S. was sort of settled as the Wild West, and people got used to being independent and taking care of themselves, living on the wild open ranges. You know, when I grew up in Los Angeles, I really couldn't understand why you would want to own a gun until I thought people were going to break my window and come into my house. I really couldn't understand why would I need a gun. And then I spent some time in a very rural part of California where there actually were wild animals. There were wild boars that would actually gore you. There were mountain lions that could, you know, jump off of a cliff or off of a rock and, you know, kill you in a matter of seconds. You know, there were real reasons why you would want to have a gun. And I could not imagine walking around in an environment like that without one. So you also have to bear in mind, regardless of your position on guns, that, you know, different parts of the country probably, you know, have very different relationships with firearms for a whole lot of different reasons. All right, I want to correct something that I said earlier in the show. I want to put out a shout of thanks to Donovan, who is our very, very eagle-eyed and eagle-eared board operator. And he pointed out to me that my story about George Bush not recognizing a grocery store scanner was apocryphal. That's a great word. It was false. It was fake. It was bogus. And if you go to Snopes.com, you can actually read the full story. I'll give you just a little headline here. Here's the claim. During a photo opportunity at a 1988 grocers convention, President George Bush, this would be the junior George Bush, or excuse me, the senior George Bush, was, quote, amazed at encountering supermarket scanners for the first time. And Snopes.com, these are the rumor buster people, they report that the status of this story is false. All right. The origins, the ability of a single image to influence and shape history has long been a part of American politics. Even before there was a USA, Paul Revere's inaccurate engraving of the Boston Massacre helped solidify colonial support for a break with Great Britain. In more recent times, they're talking about George Bush found himself a victim of photo manipulation, and it goes on and on. You can read it. Snopes.com. Look up Bush. Let's see, Bush Supermarket Scanner in Snopes.com. You can read the whole story. And we'll post a link to it on our archives as well. So my apologies if I inadvertently misled you on that. Apparently even I can fall for these on occasion. All right, we'll be right back on the other end of this break. We'll have a little bit of news at the top of the hour, and then we'll come right back and talk about some top stories in the news, including some developments on the RFID front that you probably ought to know about, like it or not. We'll be right back. And we're back. You are listening to the Dr. Catherine Ulbrich Show, trying to get you to smile a little bit. I'm trying to keep the negativity to a dull roar, if that is possible in the crazy times that we're living in. The phone lines are open, 1-800-259-9231. I've also got my email address, kma@spychips.com, at your disposal if you'd like to write in and tell me what's on your mind this afternoon in the quest for freedom and a better country and overall goodness. You could drop me a line, kma@spychipswithanass.com. Do me a favor, put the word radio somewhere in the subject bar so I can get right to your right to your important missive. All right, a couple of things I want to tell you. Just before the break there at the bottom of the hour, or the end of the last hour, we were talking about the issue of gun control. I have a couple more resources for you. One of them, gunowners.org. That is Gun Owners of America. That's Larry Pratt's organization, good friend of mine and a wonderful guy. Gunowners.org has additional information, and I figured out which of the books I was trying to get the name of is John Lott's book, L-O-T-T. He is a fellow in law and economics at the University of Chicago School of Law, and his book is titled More Guns, Less Crime: Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws. And he did some very extensive research that was statistically scrupulous, I mean, just absolutely impeccable research, and discovered that when gun control laws go into effect, that people actually are less safe after the gun control laws are in effect than they are beforehand. Don't believe me? Let me give you a couple of pieces of evidence here. He's got an article here. This is from the Wall Street Journal back in 1999, and things really haven't changed since then. Gun laws can be dangerous, too. Some excerpts from his book, and he talks about some of the issues. This was under the Clinton administration, my gosh, talking about, let's see, what does he say? Waiting periods, a three-day waiting period for handgun purchases could not possibly have stopped the Littleton, Colorado attack, which the killers have been planning for a year. Mandatory gun locks. This is sort of telling you why these gun control issues won't stop the problem. And then he goes into more details as to why it would make it worse. Mandatory gun locks. This proposal, too, is unrelated to the attack in Colorado. Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold would have known how to unlock their guns. Going on, what do we have here? Prison sentences for adults whose guns are misused by someone under 18. Parents are already civilly liable for wrongful actions committed by their children, he says. New rules for gun shows, and you know, it's just mortifying me because every single thing in here talks about the Clinton administration this and the Clinton administration that, just reminding me yet again that one of the roles of the Democrats in this sort of passion play that goes back and forth and ping-pongs us from the left to the right is to relentlessly chip away at our gun rights. And I'm remembering under the Clinton administration how absolutely horrible this debate was, because we were continually on the defensive, constantly having to defend our right to, our constitutionally protected right, may I add, to own a gun. And it just goes on, new rules for gun show. These are all the things Clinton wanted to do in this particular article. Waiting periods, mandatory gun locks, prison sentences for adults whose guns are misused by someone under 18, new rules for gun shows, age limits, background checks for purchasers of any material that could be used in the creation of a bomb, even if it's fertilizer. Can you imagine? You just want to, like, you know, put a little fertilizer on the beans in your backyard, and you've got to show ID and give them a driver's license number and a thumbprint. All of this stuff was coming up under the Clinton administration, and all of this stuff is going to come up again under the Obama administration. It's going to be shocking. This was not the article that I thought I was going to be reading from, which talks about why more guns lead to less crime, but you can find that online pretty easily. Just look for John Lott, L-O-T-T, and More Guns, Less Crime. He's got lots and lots of articles explaining why it is that gun laws leave people vulnerable, and ultimately, when communities are well-armed, that they're also well-defended. So, there you go. All right, a little bit on guns. Had to get that in. I have another article in front of me. I want to get your thoughts on this. Now, as you guys know, if you're regular listeners to the show, I don't use a credit card. I don't make purchases with numbers to the extent that I can possibly avoid it. I can count on my fingers the number of times I've used a credit card in my memory.
And there were a period of many years ago when I first graduated college that I did use credit cards, and then I came to the realization that I did not want all of my purchases tracked, so I quit cold turkey. Well, there's an article out now by AP retail writer Ann DiNocencio. I've done a number of interviews with her in the past. And tell me what you think of this. The title is More Customers Resume Using Old-Fashioned Cash. Now, let me read you this. She says, cash or credit for more Americans who have already maxed out their credit cards or are just trying to manage their spending better in the tough economy, the answer is increasingly the old-fashioned one, cash. Retailers like Walmart, Target, and JCPenney are noticing a market shift away from credit cards in favor of cash and debit cards. A big factor is less credit available as major card issuers cut spending limits and raise fees, even for customers who pay their bills on time. Now, here's the key. I want you to listen to this and tell me if you agree or not. This shift ends America's long love affair with credit cards and is one of the changes in consumer behavior that has emerged since the financial meltdown that could depress consumer spending this holiday season and impact shoppers' habits long afterward. And it goes on, particularly during holiday seasons past, shoppers could count on a pile of plastic to give them the extra spending power to get through Christmas. And then it goes on, and this is the one I think is particularly interesting. Even with the economy recovering, or even when the economy recovers and credit loosens up, analysts say Americans, shaped by what could be a deep and lasting recession, are likely to stick with buying only what they can afford, just as their parents or grandparents did after the Great Depression. Do you believe it? Are you switching? Are you a credit card user who has switched over to using cash or a debit card? Let me know. 1-800-259-9231. Do you work in retail? Have you been around people work in retail? Have you noticed an upswing in the use in cash? And if so, do you really think it is a permanent shift in people's mindset? Or do you think it's because they've had to max out their credit cards because they've lost their jobs and are afraid of losing their homes, and now they don't have the credit card option anymore? I'm not really sure, but this idea in here what does this one guy say? This guy, Robert Smith, who's shopping with his wife and they interview him. He says, I think this is a new way of life. He and his wife had been using cash and debit cards to finance their spending now ever since they paid off their credit card debts in July. He says, I like to be able to know that we paid for something. I hate monthly payments when you use a credit card. And with the average amount of consumer debt in this country up into, what are we at now? I don't know. It was some amazing figure last time I looked. It was I'd have to pull it back up again. But it was literally up into the staggering numbers of thousands of dollars per capita of credit card, of average credit card debt that we Americans lug around with us like so much overweight like last year's Christmas around the belly. That it certainly is time for Americans to give up their love affair with the credit card. But do you think it's really going to happen? And it surprises me when she says this. She really doesn't cite any particular statistics in this article that would really convince me that it is happening. It's more sort of anecdotal, you know, that some of these retailers report. Well, how do I know they report that? I would almost think it'd be the other way around, that as the economy toughens up and sours up and people lose their jobs, that they may be turning more to the plastic to fund their lifestyle and try to at least keep food on the table until they get that elusive next job. Who knows? But if you know, let me know. 1-800-259-9231. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Running madly, I don't really know from what. I've been living my whole life like some phrase at the tip of my tongue. Don't really know how to say it, it's always just out of reach. Stays locked away in my larynx along with my freedom of speech. I'll use a rubber on my shoes to erase all that I've done. And if I just keep adding miles and miles to the souls, I can erase all that's gone wrong. Some people write their stories with ink and a ballpoint pen, but I'll use the rubber on my shoes till streets and rivers end.
All right, we're back. Talking about cash, are people really going to make the switch to cash when economic times get rough? I suppose ultimately, if they have their credit cut off completely, they may wind up doing it. But I'm having a hard time believing that Americans are making a big transition over to actually pulling out cash. I certainly haven't seen it. The people in front of me in the line, the people behind me in the line, the people all around me in retail stores seem to be almost universally heading straight for the credit card swipe unit that is now ubiquitous at every possible retail chain checkout lane. And that seems to be the default experience. In fact, I recently tried to buy, I can't remember what I was buying, but I paid with a $100 bill, and the cashier just looked at me like, what do you expect? What do you think I am? What do you think I have here, a cash register? What do you think? You think I can just pull out change for you like that? I'm like, well, yeah, you're a store, right? Aren't you? Most people use that. She points to the credit card swipe machine. So I'm not sure I'm really buying it. It would be great news if it were the case, if people could actually learn to live within their means. You know, one of the big advantages to paying cash is that you never wind up having to pay for something that you bought and experienced and enjoyed and long forgot about months before. When you look at the amount of average credit card debt and you say, well, how much of that was on durable goods that you're still enjoying to this day? And the answer in most cases is practically none. Blew it on a vacation. You know, I got some good photographs, a couple of memories, but that's long gone. Blew it on a whole bunch of meals out at restaurants. Well, you know, that was fun for that couple of hours, maybe. Got me through the night. But the following day, it was just a memory. Maybe spent that money on movie tickets or spent that money on clothing that probably already is worn out and buttons gone by the time you pay for it. And when you understand that not only are you paying for this stuff years after you've enjoyed it in many cases, but you're also paying exorbitant levels of interest on it. That's why they want it. You know, everywhere you go, would you like to save $10 off your order by getting a Sears credit card? Would you like to save 10% off your order today if you sign up for a blah, blah, blah credit card? Why do you think they're constantly pushing these things at you? Because they are a money maker in their own right. That's why. They make money off them in two different ways. Number one, they sell more stuff because research has shown that when you're not paying real actual money, you spend more. So they're going to actually get you to spend more money in the store. And, of course, if you want to get that 10% off, then you really want to max up your purchases. But they also know that they will be collecting from you, you know, 18, 20, 23% interest, usurious interest rates. That's a great word, the word usury, meaning criminally high interest rates, that they will be charging you on something that you will consume and forget all about and be saddled with those payments. So I do indeed hope that people are beginning to wisen up to the fact that all of these credit cards they're a scam. They're a way to kind of put you into indentured servitude. You know, it's like a lot of the early arrivals to our shores here in the United States came over as indentured servants from Europe because they couldn't afford the passage. It was actually quite expensive to spend all that time on a boat and be fed and given a bed and brought over here safely. So what a lot of people did was they essentially sold themselves. They sold their services. They had nothing else to sell. They didn't have any money. They didn't have any property. And they sold themselves, in some cases giving 3 or 5 or even 7 years worth of their service in exchange for nothing more than a passage and a room and a bed when they got there for a brief span of time. And in exchange for that, they became essentially slaves. They signed up to be enslaved, to be someone else's servant for a span of time. And you can't get out from under that until you've served your sentence, essentially. And that's what we're all doing with these credit cards. That's what we're all doing with the credit cards. When you use a credit card and you're carrying $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 worth of debt, you are enslaved. You have to keep working. You must stay on the treadmill because you got to pay these guys back, and you're getting nothing for it. It's not like a mortgage where your payment, at least a portion of it, goes towards something that you're actually going to own. It's not like an education where your tuition payments go towards something that'll be with you forever. It's just throwaway money. And it reminds me, I'm trying to think, it was Chris Hufnagel from, at the time he was working for Epic, the privacy organization, and he shared a statistic with me outside of one of these many hearings that we've been to, and it was explaining why the credit card companies want you to, what was it? It was when you make a phone call to them, they want to have all your information already on their computer screens. Oh, no, it's even richer than that. You know what it was? It was so when the telemarketers call you that they can already know in advance who you are and already have your credit card information on their screen at the ready. This is one of the things that they were complaining about, privacy advocates trying to change this. But they wanted to be able to have your phone number, call you up, and have your credit card details already on their screen. So they could say to you, you know, I've got a timeshare condominium in Tampa that I think you'd really like. And when you go, well, yeah, that sounds pretty good. Then they'd say, yes, may I charge it to your Visa account? I've got the information right here. Because that spur of the moment impulse purchase is really valuable to them. They know that the research, and this is what Chris was sharing with me, that if you actually have the experience of removing the card, you know, you have to say, well, hang on a second, let me go get my credit card, that during that span of time when you're off the phone from the telemarketer, and you're actually walking across the room to get your purse. Most women would probably have their credit card somewhere else. You men might have it right in your pocket, in your wallet. But we women have to, you know, hang on a second, set the phone down, walk into the kitchen, you know, grab the purse off the counter, open it up, open our wallets, pull out the credit card, walk back to the phone. And during that interim, during that interval of clear thinking, when you're not being immediately pitched by this fast-talking salesperson, a lot of times common sense settles in and you say, well, wait a minute. Looking at this credit card, the logo on it is reminding me of the bill sitting on my desk for $23,000. And do I really need to buy a gold-plated bottle opener for $49.99? Do I really need to add that onto my already explosive credit card debt? And then you build up your resolve. You strengthen your nerve. You get back on the phone and you say to the guy or the gal, you know, I'm sorry, I decided I really am not interested after all. Goodbye. Click. And the next thing they hear is a dial tone. So what they discovered is that if you can cause the consumer to bypass that conscious process, that you can achieve far more sales. So not only did they figure that out, which is why they want these swipeless credit cards that you just wave past the reader and it'll read right through your wallet. You don't even have to look at it and remember the bill on your desk. But they also found that when people order fast food with a credit card, of all things, that they order on average, I think it was like 30% more food. So, you know, yet another reason. Let's have everybody pay for the fast food with a credit card because we'll be making 30% more money. Of course, we'll all be getting 30% fatter and 30% poorer, but they don't care. All right, we'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Your teeth, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me. The way your smile just beams, the way you sing off key, the way you haunt my dreams. No, no, they can't take that away from me. We may never, never meet again on the bumpy road to love. Still I always, always keep the memory of the way you hold your knife, the way we dance till three, the way you change your life. No, no, they can't take that away from me. No, they can't take that away from me.
Oh, no, No, they can't. Can't get inside my head. No, off limits, honey. That's mine. All right, a couple of news items. I appreciate all the people who've written in with email. My email address, kma@spychips.com. Richard writes in and mentions or reminds me that I've been remiss in not talking about that full-page advertisement printed in the Chicago, I thought it was in the Chicago Tribune. He says in the Chicago Times. This is, of course, Bob Schultz, our very good friend from We the People, the not We the People Radio Network, but We the People, the National Civil Liberties and Constitutional Organization that has been doing such great work on income tax, has also been, Bob Schultz has been very busy, as we know from having him as a guest on the show, filing lawsuits against both the bailout and against Obama going forward as being sworn in as our 44th president, with all of this controversy still swirling around the status of his birth certificate, which has really been, had a lot of people very, very concerned about that. We the People Foundation, let me read you a little update from them. And again, thanks to Richard Bemis for sending this in to us. He writes, hang on. An open letter to Barack Obama. Now, as you'll recall, if you did miss it, you can catch it in the archives. We had Bob Schultz on the program, and he read this letter to us. Absolutely riveting, and there's a whole lot of evidence indicating that Barack Obama may not be constitutionally eligible to assume the presidency. So this open letter was printed, I want to say, in the Chicago Tribune, but I guess it was in the Chicago Times. Dear Mr. Obama, and then you've got the whole lengthy list of letters where they ask for the following documentary evidence to be submitted to the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. by 10 a.m. on December 8th, 2008. That would be just 5 days from now. A certified copy of your original signed vault birth certificate. Certified copies of your reissued and sealed birth certificates in the names Barack Hussein Obama, Barry Sotoro, Barry Obama, Barack Dunham, and Barry Dunham, a certified copy of your certification of citizenship, a certified copy of your oath of allegiance taken upon the age of maturity, certified copies of your admission forms for Occidental College, Columbia University, and Harvard Law School, all of which would have contained information about this, and certified copies of any legal documents involving changing your name. Each member of the Electoral College who is committed to casting a vote on December 15th has a constitutional duty to make certain that you are a natural-born citizen. As of today, there is no evidence in the public record, nor have you provided any, that defeats the claim that you are barred by law from assuming the office of president because you fail the Constitution's eligibility requirements. Wow, wouldn't that be a mind-blower? Wouldn't that be a mind blower if that were to happen, if they actually were to pull this off? So on, I guess the 10th, what is that, Monday coming up? No, let me see. On the 10th, that would be next Wednesday. It looks like Bob Schultz has got a press conference set up in Washington, D.C., and will be assembling members of the media to see if Barack Obama responds to this or not. And, you know, how is Obama supposed to respond? What if he can't produce these documents? You know, then he's going to stall, he's going to hem, he's going to haw, he's going to defer, he's going to dismiss, he's going to do everything he can to wave his arms and dismiss this like a little gnat buzzing around his head, but he's not going to produce the documents. And if he does produce the documents, then there's going to be a whole lot of scrutiny to make sure that they're legitimate and not forgeries. I mean, I think this is, you know, a totally juicy soap opera here, don't you? Very interesting. So is Barack Obama a natural-born citizen of the U.S.? And what does the Constitution allow for in the event that he is found ineligible? I don't even know. Would the elected vice president take office? Would we get Joe Biden as president if that were the case? Is that I don't know if that's if the Constitution even addresses the issue of a president who has not yet been sworn into office, either dying or becoming ineligible. I don't know if we have any precedent for that or if it's addressed. If you do know, and you want to set me straight, 1-800-259-9231. I'd love to know the answer to that. But this is a terrific letter. You can find it online at wethepeoplefoundation.org. And we're all kind of on the edge of our seats. Richard writes in, let me read you from his note because he's got some additional updates here. He says, no one in the media is covering this. It appears the Supreme Court is going to stay the Electoral College until all this can be resolved. They're expected to put the hold on them on Friday, 2 days from now. Enjoy your show. And Vivian Britton says hi. Well, hi back to Vivian. She was a wonderful guest on our show last year when we were on We the People Radio Network. Vivian, the grocery girl. She's actually the enlightened misanthrope and does a lot more than that. She's got a terrific blog online if you want to check her out. Vivian Britton, B-R-I-T-T-O-N. But I had her on talking about groceries, one of my favorite topics. Anyway, so that's the latest update on the open letter to Barack Obama. Fascinating stuff, and we'll just have to kind of sit back and see what happens. I don't know who to put pressure on at this point, other than just to keep those editorials flowing to the media outlets and saying, hey guys, why aren't you covering this? Don't you think this is important? Don't you think this is huge? and you purport to be the mainstream media letting us know what's going on in the mainstream. Hey, you know, this is pretty mainstream, affecting the potential future of the office of the president of this country. Serious stuff. All right, let me go back to those phone lines, 1-800-259-9231, and let me say good afternoon to Leo, calling us from Massachusetts. Hey, Leo.
Hi. Sorry I missed you at the Fed demo. I must have gotten there, left too early.
Oh, we were outside of the Federal Reserve. Absolutely.
Yeah,
that was
what
a great event.
There?
It was really cold, though. I was there like noon to 6.
Really? You were there from noon?
I was. I showed up when the
event
was in full swing. I am sure.
Are you short
shirt.
And have blonde hair?
No, I'm not. I'm tall and have red hair.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was there at 12, so I was surprised I didn't see you. Anyway.
Well, I was being introduced around to everybody. I made the rounds and shook hands and did all of that, but maybe we just missed each other. Anyway, I'm sure you did you call in about the Barack Obama letter?
Yeah, I also heard Jody Wood today. Have you ever had her on?
I had not.
You know about her, right?
I don't.
Oh my goodness! It's she can be found at.
Well, who is she first
Google
of all? Who are we talking
Wood.
About? Judy Woods.
Right?
Judy
yeah,
Woods.
Judy Wood. She does things about energy weapons, and it's on www.dr and then judywood.com.
Okay.
But as far as the Barack Obama thing is concerned, all things being said, I don't care if he's a Muslim. I don't care if he's from Kenya. I mean, one thing that really bothers me is that he had dual citizenship up until the time he's 21. Now, I knew way before I could have had dual citizenship with my mother's country.
What country is that?
Sri Lanka.
Okay.
And I was over there, but I traveled on her passport, and I came back on my own. But the thing is that he waited till 21 to let his passport expire. I think that's truly bogus.
Well, there's a whole lot of pieces to this that really kind of raise your eyebrows. I mean, there's so many pieces, and they've really kind of effectively kept from us the fact that this is a man who spent many of his formative years outside of this country. You know, he's not what we think of when we think of a true blue American.
I mean,
in that sense.
He was asked to stay out of Kenyan politics.
Yeah, we'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Okay, we're back. That was Mojo Nixon doing that little I Hate Banks ditty. Quite a funny song. Kind of R-rated, though. I had to bleep out a couple of words, but he's always a hoot. And I bet there's a whole lot of people feeling like they hate banks right now for a whole lot of reasons as we watch our economy come tumbling around our ears. All right, we've got Leo in Massachusetts on the line. Leo, just before the break, you were saying something, which is escaping me at this point. Do you remember?
Oh, about Obama's birth certificate thing?
Well, yeah. I was thinking he was saying
that I was kind of surprised that he hung around with a dual citizenship for all those years, not figuring who he wants to be. I mean, to me, that's a bit weird. I mean, I find that the most obnoxious aspect of his whole...
Well, I actually have some friends who are privacy advocates who actually left the country in order to have their baby outside the country so the baby would specifically have dual citizenship. So when the U.S. becomes an oppressive dictatorship, they'll have somewhere to run to.
Well, I think most countries that they'd want to go to would accept you as a refugee.
You think?
I don't know about that.
You know, it's not only that. If it becomes a police state, if they start using that border fence to keep us in, then,
you know... In a constitution-free zone 100 miles around the whole border?
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder how many people know about that.
Well, it's a search and seizure zone where the Fifth Amendment does not apply to you. And I actually live within the borders of that 100-mile constitution-free search and seizure zone, by the way. The entire state of New Hampshire is within that 100-mile zone. But my point really, you know, when I think about those border fences going up on the southern border, I always remember the opening scene to the movie The Handmaid's Tale, the Margaret Atwood novel that was turned into a movie. And in that movie, you know, it's just normal life. People live in a normal, you know, just normal day-to-day events, and all of a sudden her ATM card doesn't work, her credit cards don't work, she can't figure out what's going on, and it turns out there's been a coup, and a bunch of crazed religious leaders have taken over the government, and she tries to escape, she and her husband and their, I don't know, four-year-old daughter, whoever they are, they're running through the snow, it's such a vivid scene, they're running through the snow trying to get past a border checkpoint to escape. This is not a border checkpoint into another country, it's to get the heck out of the United States. And they get caught, and it's a gut-wrenching scene when there they are on the snow getting caught. And I think her daughter and her husband make it away, but she gets caught and dragged off and imprisoned for trying to leave. So that's all, you know, whenever somebody starts talking about, you know, really secure borders, I get really nervous. I don't think secure borders to keep other people out. I start picturing them keeping me in. And if I could at least wave around my, I don't know, my Nigerian passport or my, you know, my Anguilla passport or whatever the heck I had from some other country, it would at least allow me to get the heck out of this one.
Well, you know, Cynthia McKinney was prevented from going to a conference because they wouldn't let her out of the country.
Why was that?
Oh, check on Alex Jones' site. He's got a whole dirty on the skinny on that one.
Cynthia McKinney, yeah. All right.
Anyway,
And we know Ted Kennedy's on the terrorist watch list, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a joke.
He belongs on it.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I did meet Bob Schultz one time. He came to Concord and spoke, and that was delightful. But, you know, I think the real point is we're still not getting what we have here is a failure to communicate, and we're not breaking through to the major community, and we really have to stay on this because otherwise we're dead in the water. I mean, I think we should contact Colonel Craig Roberts from News with Views. He's really quite interesting and, you know, make a good guest.
All right. Well, I appreciate the tip. Thanks for weighing in. And, you know, it remains to be seen. I guess Friday is going to be kind of a turning point in the next week. On Wednesday, they'll hold a press conference and they may or may not report on it. They may or may not, you know, nobody may even show up to the press conference other than independent media outlets. Because the powers that be that have installed Obama into this position are probably trembling in their own boots. They want him to be the next president. They've already invested a huge sum of money in making that happen, and they don't want to see that victory grasped out of their hands over what they would probably consider a technicality, a very important one, but a technicality nonetheless. I'm sure they would see it that way. And so I'm sure they're calling in all their favors and doing everything they can to try to prevent this thing from getting legs and really becoming a big issue. And who knows? You know, I'd love to know what goes on. I'd love to be a fly in the wall as the Supreme Court sits around talking about this. you know, they've got their political loyalties as well, even though they're appointed for life. They've still certainly got ideological and political masters that they serve, too. So I'm very, very interesting to see where that goes. All right, couple of stories I want to bring up just as we wrap up the hour. I need to let you know that I am going to be at a conference tomorrow and Friday, so I will be pulling out one of the absolute best of encore programs, and we'll make sure it's a good one and get you some serious food for thought to chew on and mull for Thursday and Friday. I will be back first thing Monday morning and hitting the news yet again, so you can look forward to seeing me on Monday afternoon. And a couple of stories I want to cover just to kind of wrap up this week for me. Indonesian AIDS Commission rejects plan to tag sufferers. Did you guys hear this? That the nation of Indonesia has a province called Papua, you know, Papua New Guinea, one of the most backward of Indonesia's provinces. And in the province of Papua, they have a big AIDS problem, a whole lot of people with HIV, HIV-positive people, and there is a concern that they are spreading the disease by engaging in irresponsible behaviors that are infecting other people. And as a response to this, they cooked up a preposterous idea that they would inject these AIDS patients, these positive testers, and people who test positive for the disease, with a Verichip microchip implant into their flesh. And what kills me about this story is that they actually, with a straight face, say, this is a lawmaker who actually proposed some legislation on this, with a straight face, actually say that this would help them monitor the spread of the disease. Now, if you've read our book, Spy Chips, if you've listened to this program for any length of time, if you've logged on to antichips.com and read the extensive FAQ, the easy to read, may I add, FAQ of questions about the Verichip, if you know anything about the Verichip at all, you know that human microchip implants, at least in their current technological state of development, are not capable of being read from more than about 6 inches away. They are like barcode scanners, practically. They do not have long read range. They will not pinpoint the location of people anywhere on the globe. They won't even pinpoint the location of a person across a room or even across a table from you, because the read range on an implanted microchip is about 6 inches. That's it. So if you did put these into AIDS patients, I really fail to see what kind of public health impact it would have at all. There's really no way that it would be used to monitor risky behaviors, which is what they claim they want to be doing, and prevent the spread of the disease. Unless, you know, people before they choose intimate partners are scanning them with microchip scanners that cost hundreds of dollars apiece in one of the poorest parts of the world. I don't think so. I don't think it's going to happen. All right. The nation of Indonesia is one of the most populous nations in the world. I believe they are number four. I think they're number four. Yep, they are the world's fourth most populous country. Can you believe that? We rarely hear about them when we think of big population nations. But Indonesia is huge. And if they were to set the precedent of microchipping AIDS patients, we would all be in a world of bad precedent hurt. And when I say bad precedent, you know, once one country does it, once one group of guys does it, then the next guys go, well, you know, it's not like we're doing something that hasn't been done before. Look at those guys over there in the world's fourth most populous country microchipping their AIDS patients. So we need to do the same thing. So this is a very serious threat. It's one that's a little bit difficult to respond to, of course, as an activist based in the U.S. I don't have a private jet that I can just fly out to Indonesia. I don't have a lot of resources where I can just, you know, throw a whole bunch of money at getting some Indonesian organizations in opposition. So we definitely need to get involved and fight this. And this would be a moment when I would encourage you that if you have ever thought about supporting my work in the past, now would be a very good time to do it. You can log on to KatherineAlbrecht.com, and I think, hang on a second, when you log on there, there is a Make a Gift section that I would encourage you to click and think about helping me to respond to what's going on in Indonesia. Good news, we do have the AIDS Commission in Indonesia has come out strongly in opposition to this. So one of my next moves is going to be to get in touch with them, make some phone calls down to Indonesia, and see if I can arrange to fly out there and actually testify, let these guys know that this stuff causes cancer, that it does not enable anyone to be tracked or monitored, that it can't be read from a satellite. I know these all sound like no-brainer things, but that's why you testify, because oftentimes the people proposing this stuff don't even know it. All right. That's it for today. You've been listening to Dr. Catherine Albrecht online at CatherineAlbrecht.com. We'll do it all again on Monday, and I'll see you then. Meanwhile, say a prayer for me as I head off for my conference, and may God richly bless and keep you all. Bye-bye.